Okay, welcome back. Hello? Oh, here we go. Welcome back. This third program, our keynote address, gives me some great pleasure to introduce a fellow architect to you who is responsible for many significant memorials in this country. I'd like to welcome Michael Arad, FAIA, as our keynote speaker. His design for the National 9/11 Memorial at the World Trade Center, titled Reflecting Absence, was selected by the Lower Manhattan Development Corporation for more than 5,000 entries. Mr. Arad joined the New York firm of Handel Architects and is a partner as of April 2004. I should note, he works around the world. He is a native of Israel. He was raised here, the United Kingdom, and in Mexico. He came to the United States and earned a bachelor's degree from Dartmouth College in 1994, and a master's of architecture from Georgia Institute of Technology in 1997. I have to say that it's a fine school, but not as good as some of the other schools we have. In 2017, this is important because it follows the discussion we just had, Mr. Arad was selected to design a memorial to the victims of the 2015 Charleston Church massacre at the Mother Emanuel AME Church in Charleston. So we bring the present right up here now. And this is our last and final. Please join me in welcoming Michael Arad.
Thank you for welcoming Rambling Rack from Georgia Tech. My name is Michael Arad, and it's a pleasure to be here. It's my ninth trip here in 9 months, and I've come to learn, and as the last panel reiterated, that the past is not even past here. So I also learned that, you know, that even in New York, the Confederacy is still alive. All joking aside, I was actually on a panel this last year that Mayor de Blasio, New York, convened to look at monuments and markers in public space and to understand if they are appropriate for the day and age that we're in, if they reflect a past in a way that is inconsistent with the values of the society that we seek to have now. And one of the key takeaways for the commission in analyzing these monuments and memorials across New York was when and by who and for what reason were these monuments erected. And very often there's quite a few years between the events and the commemoration. And you know, there was a lot of uproar, for example, about Christopher Columbus. But when that monument was erected, Italian Americans were a minority in this country that were treated, that were disenfranchised, that were lynched in New Orleans. And although the man himself did many reprehensible things, the spirit with which that memorial was erected was about a sense of inclusion within the American society by Italian Americans at the time. And I think that's important in analyzing any piece of work, not just who is represented there, but who chose to put it up, when did they choose to put it up, and for what reasons, and we'll leave it at there. I will talk today primarily about the 9/11 memorial, and I think there are some moments of resonance there. Oops.
Sorry. Mark, we need you.
Mark wanted to keep me on my toes. He didn't give a presentation up until 10 seconds before I got up. Let me start clicking through the slides, otherwise they will disappear. like, what's it called, Snapchat? In New York, I was in New York on September 11th and witnessed the attacks firsthand, and that impacted me greatly. But I think what impacted me even more was how New Yorkers responded to the attack, how something that was meant to sow fear and dissent and was met with sort of quiet defiance and compassion. And I think the reason that New York responded that way is because we have public spaces in New York that allowed New Yorkers to come together to support one another and to respond as a community. And I think you saw that here in Charleston too, in the aftermath of the church shooting. When I started to think about a memorial in New York, it was a few weeks after the attack, and I could not imagine actually building anything at the site of the World Trade Center at the time. It was a six-story high pile of rubble, and bodies were being pulled out of the flames and the ash and the smoke. And so I set my sights further west, a couple blocks further towards the Hudson River, and I imagine two voids in the surface of the river sort of shorn open, forming these two squares, and the water rushing into these voids, never filling them, sort of the sense of time not erasing that inexplicable absence. And so the sketch, the Hudson River on the left, Battery Park City on the right, led me to build a small model that you see here. I was working in New York as an immigrant, as I am, and on an H-1B visa that expired in 2001. And what should have been a very routine renewal for another three-year term became jammed up as the INS was folded into Homeland Security, and I found myself with a lot of free time on my hands when I couldn't go back to work. And it was during that year that that sketch became this model. And that model I took up to the rooftop of my apartment building in the East Village, where I'd actually witnessed the second plane strike the South Tower. I was at home, I heard that a plane had struck the World Trade Center, I saw smoke billowing out from the North Tower. I walked up to that rooftop and saw the second plane strike. And I came back to that rooftop and photographed this model, this idea of making absence visible against the skyline of New York City. And I could see the absence of those towers somehow mirrored and reflected in these two voids in the foreground. And I did this very much as a sort of a cathartic, self-directed exercise for myself. There was no client, no brief. It was just a need to respond to what I had seen in some way. Some people paint, some people write poetry. I built a little model, and then I set it aside about a year later, and I came back to it following the selection of a master plan for the site. New Yorkers of every background, not just architects and planners, were incredibly intrigued and interested in how would the World Trade Center site be rebuilt? How would that reflect upon us as New Yorkers? And there was a master plan by Daniel Liebskin that was selected for the redevelopment of the site. The site is in this 16-acre quadrant right here. It's now bisected by Greenwich and by Fulton, but in the 1960s, what looked pretty much like this became one giant block, one super block. That notion of sort of erasing twelve small city blocks and creating one super block that the World Trade Center towers and the other buildings that were part of it stood on has become a discredited planning philosophy because it really is antithetical to what the streets and blocks of New York are about. And the master plan suggested breaking down that 16-acre super block into four unequal quadrants by bringing Greenwich and Fulton back through the site. In effect, creating an 8-acre site where the towers had once stood that would be dedicated to a memorial and other cultural facilities. That master plan suggested rebuilding the 10 million square feet of office space that had been destroyed in five new towers, which would surround that 8-acre parcel. And then that, and you can see the light green footprints of the former tower were bridged over by one building and another building cantilevered over another. But to me, most disappointingly, the entire site, this 8-acre site, was kept some 60 feet below the surrounding street level, in effect cutting it off entirely from the day-to-day life of New York. And you would have to descend down a long ramp here or escalators here to arrive at the Memorial Plaza. And these images that you see behind me were actually part of the competition brief in 2003 that solicited suggestions for what memorial should go in that space. I thought about my own experiences in New York and how important public space was to the city's recovery. I thought about going to Washington Square Park a couple of nights after the attack and standing at that fountain in the middle of the park. It was 2 or 3 in the morning. The park was almost empty. There were a dozen or so people standing around that fountain. And the moment that I walked up to the edge of that fountain and joined that group of people, I felt supported, and I felt that I was supporting them in turn, that we were in this together. There was a sense of congregation, of community. And the sort of despair that had hovered over me seemed to lift a little bit. And I think that was because New York provided us with places like that, whether it's Union Square or Washington Square or even street corners. So when I saw this proposal, it felt like it was just completely in the wrong direction. So I ignored the competition guidelines entirely and sent in a proposal that suggested raising everything up to street level, creating a plaza that's ringed by this, by Fulton and Liberty and Greenwich and West, and putting those two voids, which I previously imagined in the Hudson River, on a memorial plaza. And it was like, you know, writing a letter to the editor. You know, our country's foreign policy is deeply misguided. And then waking up the next day and being told you're going to be Secretary of State. So here was the design. This was the board that I sent in, an anonymous entry, one of 5,000. It's impossible for you to see it, but the last few words here talk about on their way to work or play. So there was a long description of what the memorial would do as a memorial, but I thought it was important to also talk about what this site also had to do for people who live in this neighborhood, for people who work in this neighborhood, and how it needed to bring together these different groups. That if you set it aside as a site only for memory, it would wither away. It would not be part of New York. And I thought about how my experiences of these public spaces in New York, they could transmute themselves into something different. They could be a farmer's market one day, but they could be a site for a vigil the next night. And that power to serve across these needs of the city was so important. And I wanted to stress that to the jury when I sent in this proposal. So here you see that plaza elevated to street level, and some memorial galleries behind those waterfalls, some 30 feet below plaza level. You would descend down behind that waterfall, look at the city through this veil of water, and encounter the names there. I was one of 8 finalists in late 2003 when I came to see the site. It was still, you know, most of the rescue and recovery effort ended some 9 months after the attack. But you could still see, for example, some of the subterranean parking levels below the World Trade Center. You could see the slurry wall that Daniel Liebskin, the master planner, spoke eloquently about, and he wanted to maintain that wall as a visible testament to the violence and the endurance of the violence that occurred here and the endurance of New York. That wall, had it failed, the entire subway system would have flooded. And that wall was never meant to be exposed. It had always been a subterranean element of the structure. And I thought, I understood why he wanted to exhibit it, but I thought we could make it part of the museum as it is today, rather than an open-air element as he had envisioned it. And I came across these cut-off steel columns, these box columns, which had once supported the towers. They connected the tower to its foundation, and in the recovery effort, they were torch-cut, and you could see that mark, that sort of harsh and rough edge. And I thought, you could put a new steel column here, and you would erase the memory of what happened here. It would be so easy to put two new towers there, as a certain president has proposed. But I think if you would have done that, you would have lost something about the impermanence of loss. The design was developed further for the jury, and you can start to see the development of the material palette, the waterfalls, these ramps and stairs which led you down to the space behind that waterfall where you would encounter the names. And I thought that that moment of arrival here would be a powerful moment of comprehension, of understanding the scale of the towers that once stood here, the footprint of those towers, of seeing the hundreds of names ringing each pool, and arriving at a threshold that one can walk up to but not cross, a space that would be forever uninhabitable, viewed from afar. And then returning up to the plaza, transformed by that journey. I showed these materials to the jury, and they pressed me to develop the plaza in a way that would look more... they said it still looked very bleak and austere, as if you could only imagine this place being used for memorial purposes, despite my explanation that I wanted to see all these different groups come together. And I went to work trying to develop a landscape design for that plaza that would not overwhelm that first and important gesture of the flat plane and the two voids which are carved out from it, those two voids which symbolize to me that absence, that emptiness. But I didn't want something that would be a very strong pattern. What we ended up with is the idea that I call the abacus-like bands, bands of different widths, form a paving pattern across the plaza, and then along these bands, like beads running on the wires of an abacus, trees are placed at different intervals, creating a sort of a soft order. You see them line up into rows when you look east or west, and that order dissipates. When you look north or south, there's a much more staggered and naturalistic effect. I showed these materials to the jury, and in January of 2004, they announced the selection of this design. I actually heard on the radio that a design had been picked, and I had not heard anything from them. In New York, we have this wonderful, peculiar institution called Alternate Side Parking. So I had to go downstairs in a cold January morning, move my car across the street. I had a dead battery. I was waiting for AAA to come, and I got a call from the LMDC asking me to come in and sign some documents. I thought at this point they just wanted me to sort of relieve them of any legal responsibility for being a competitor. And I said, it's not a good day, I'll try to come in later. And I could hear, I was a little disappointed to hear that the design had been selected and had not heard anything. And I heard this sort of slight panic in someone's voice saying, it's really important that you come in today. So, hope springs eternal. I went in and found out that I was the finalist, actually. And we went to work on realizing the design in all of its details, both the profound and emotional ones, but also the very basic and everyday ones. You know, where would the information desk be? Where would school groups meet? Where would the bathrooms be? So you can see some of the images from that time period. At the time, we also thought that we would house the unidentified remains in a more public location that had since shifted. And one of the first issues we had to tackle was the development of the waterfalls themselves. There were two very different directions we could have chosen to develop this design. And one, like you see here at Paley Park, is water clinging to the surface of a very rough texture. The wall is canted. There's a lot of water coming over the top. Or water free falling over the edge of a weir, as you see here at the World Financial Center. We ended up building a mock-up at our fountain consultant's backyard in Toronto, testing it throughout the winter and the summer. You can't really scale something like this down. You have to build it full scale. His neighbor had to get a court order to remove it because it took too long to remove it. But having that that mock-up built was instrumental in developing the design. I think many people have this notion as if a design springs fully formed from the head of the designer, but in fact it's a lengthy process and it involves many collaborators. And just these different serrations for the weir edge had a different effect on how the water would appear. And what the memorial today looks like is very similar to this mock-up, where you see these individual streams of water going over the edge of the weir. And by the time they fall about halfway down that 30-foot drop, the clarity of each individual strand is lost and becomes this woven tapestry of water. And to me, something that I had always wanted this memorial to highlight was this notion of both individual and collective loss. And I could not have imagined that the water feature itself would be a conduit for that to be expressed. And it was through this process, having that latent idea within the design, within the goals for the memorial should be, that found a way to manifest itself in this element. The names on the bronze panel here behind that waterfall, you can see how clearly you can see out through that veil. And those memorial galleries, as I mentioned earlier, to me were such a critical moment for the experience of visiting the memorial, that it was as if, you know, you've walked as far as you could go, and it's a moment of communion with the dead, and then you turn around and come back. We're meant to be, that moment was meant to be shielded in these memorial galleries. Every year, while the memorial was being built, there was a commemoration ceremony at the site, and the, you know, this photograph was taken from one of these, and this firefighter kneeling in reverence at the edge of this pool captured for me what I had hoped the memorial galleries would be, a sort of a spiritual, non-denominational space that would bring people together. And for a variety of reasons having to do with budget and security and competition between different design teams that are involved in this project, the memorial galleries were eliminated. We were told to bring the names up to plaza level. And it was one of those moments in 2006 where I felt, adrift. I was, here's a mock-up at the Brooklyn Navy Yard, and I felt like I was standing at the edge of the abyss, not knowing what are we going to put right there. And for the next year or so, we developed this design where the water, the plaza would end, the water table would be, the water feature would begin, and then it would cascade down some 30 feet. The letters forming the names would break the surface or float above it. And as you could see briefly here, the water is somewhat deeper to the right of the image than it is to the left. The notion was that you would have the required 42-inch guardrail submerged. And at the left side of the image, the water is less than 18 inches deep, not requiring a rail. We thought we'd kind of threaded the needle there from as far as all the rules and regulations we had to comply with. Our code consultant went on vacation. Somebody else came in and said, I think you've created a swimming pool. And that requires a lifeguard and a 5-foot fence in front of them, which is ridiculous. But the litigious climate that we live in, and the moment anything is in writing or in an email like that, we were told that we can no longer pursue this design direction. We were sent back to the drawing board yet again. So I thought, okay, we'll do something that's 42 inches high. And imagine this bronze vessel, and the names would be inscribed on it, and water would well out of the top of that, rushing in a torrent into the void, and then trickling across the names, sort of whispering in one direction, loud in the other. And I think there was something beautiful about the development of this idea. It almost looked like tears across the names. But this too encountered opposition, and we were sent back to square, and square one again. And what you see today, I think, came out of these multiple iterations, these multiple passes, and although it was a painful process, I don't think it could have gone any other way. There had to be a process. There had to, if we would have brought to the table the design as it is today, and I think it's been very well received, that too would have been rejected. There had to be that whole engagement of multiple constituencies at the table. And the LMDC was not necessarily the Lower Manhattan Development Corporation that initially was charged with this, was not very good at that. By the time I came on board, it was 2 years into a lot of disagreements between family groups and the Lower Manhattan Development Corporation. The responsibilities for the memorial were then handed over to the Memorial Foundation, which I think was more open and engaged people more. But I, I think it's always important to engage multiple voices, even if the request, can't be met. You should be aware of what that request is. So if you can't provide, this is how I want it to be, you can at least understand why somebody wants it to be that way. And perhaps in a different way, respond to that why rather than argue about the how. So the memorial, as it is today, there is a 2-foot-high and 8-foot-wide water table that serves as a springing point for this waterfall. And then floating above it is a bronze wing that the names are incised into. The names appear almost as shadows during the day. They're about the material that has been removed. And this element is illuminated from within at night, and the names appear as light during the night. The names, more than anything else, I think, were the biggest and most divisive issue in the entire process. What information would be included? How the names would appear, in what order. And when I was initially chosen, it was a decision that everybody was happy to give me full responsibility for. Rarely the architects get that. And I suggested something that I called a system of meaningful adjacencies, that we would query all the family members and ask them if there are names of other people who perished that day that they would like to see placed next to the name of the one that they lost. And I proposed it to the LMDC at the time, and they said, absolutely not. You know, we're not going to reach out to 3,000 families. It's not going to work, and you have to come up with another way of arranging the names. And something as simple as an alphabetical listing would not work here. Right? There are 3 Michael Lynches, 2 Michael Patrick Lynches at this memorial. If we rely just on an alphabetical listing, how would you know whose markers belongs to you, so to speak? My wife and I don't share the same last name. Other families do. An alphabetical listing would bring some couples together, some families together, drive others apart. It would bring some people that have nothing to do with each other together and drive others apart. So I suggested, and it was very difficult to make the suggestion, that we would bring no order to this, that we would let it reflect the haphazard brutality of that day, that the names would fall where they may. But I made that suggestion with a very heavy heart, knowing that there were families that traveled together on the flights that day, whose names would be scattered across both pools. And I could imagine their relatives visiting the memorial and not being able to see those names together, separated in death, so to speak. But that, if you think that was upsetting to me, you can imagine how upsetting it was to the family members. And for 2 years, fundraising for the memorial came to a complete and total standstill. Nobody contributed money to the building of this memorial because of the controversy surrounding the issue of the names. And in fact, family groups got together and came up with a competing proposal where the names would be arranged according to 5 principles. The age would be included. They would be listed by their employer. The employers would be listed alphabetically. The floor that they were on would be included. And if they had attained any rank, whether it was at the fire department or the NYPD, that would be included too. And so the names would be stacked in columns, so to speak, versus spread out and staggered, giving each name its own physical place on the memorial, which I thought was very important. To me, the name was the most important element to convey the loss of a person, not necessarily who they worked for or what age they were at the time of the death. And so you had this sort of back and forth. Mayor Michael Bloomberg became chairman of the Memorial Foundation in 2006. And this was one of the first issues he wanted to resolve when he took over as chairman. And he called me to his office, and I sat there with one of my partners at work and with Patty Harris, the deputy mayor. And Mayor Bloomberg is a very data-driven guy. And he came to the meeting with a lot of very dark questions. What happens if you include this? What happens if you change that? And what came out of that discussion was the notion of arranging the names into 9 broad groups, which reflected where people were that day. The 4 flights, the 2 towers and the Pentagon. The 93 bombing victims were also commemorated here near where that explosion took place. And the first responders, who in turn are grouped by where they came from the same firehouse, from the same precinct building. And asked the mayor if we could bring back this notion of meaningful adjacency as a corollary to this, so that within some of these groups, and some of these groups have hundreds and hundreds of names within them, we could bring that meaningful adjacency into play. And to his credit, the mayor gave us permission to pursue this idea. I mean, sort of beware of what you wish for. I think it's something most politicians would not have done. Let's imagine you get 1,000 requests and you're able to answer 500 of them. You now have 500 people that feel that they didn't get what somebody else got. That goes to counter to most people's political instincts. But the mayor agreed to that. And finally, in 2009, these packets went out to all the families asking for the verification of how they would like the name to appear, whether it was a middle initial or a full middle name or a nickname, but also if there were any meaningful adjacency requests that they had. And we got over 1,200 of these requests. And we went to work organizing the names. And this task fell to primarily to one woman in my office. Her name is Amanda Sachs, who spent close to a year working, obviously, with folks at the Memorial Foundation and other people, but arranging and rearranging and rearranging the names to try and find the right arrangement that, to the naked eye, looked consistent and correct without, without unintentional breaks, but only having those breaks when you transition from one group to another group, but also connecting with this hidden web of connections, all of the requests that we got. And so we would put these up at a quarter scale of what they actually are in reality in conference room and look at them again and again, how the names flowed from panel to panel. Even when no request was specifically made, we tried to group people together with the people that they worked with most days. I'm not a very religious person, maybe becoming a little more so, but it felt providential when at the end of this process we were able to meet all 1,200 requests. And to me it was, it's one of those hidden things. Nobody that visits a memorial knows necessarily about this. But for the families who visit this memorial, it's incredibly powerful and meaningful to come to the memorial and see these names next to one another. One of the requests that we got was from the family of a young woman who lost both her father and her best friend from college. Her father was on Flight 11 and her best friend from college was working at the North Tower. And Flight 11 actually crashed into the North Tower. Her father's name is one of the last ones under the heading Flight 11. Her friend is one of the first ones under the heading World Trade Center. And when that family visits the memorial, I think they appreciate the effort that we undertook to bring those names together. But when I share that story with you, I think it's powerful to hear it because it's no longer an abstraction. It's no longer close to 3,000 names. It's actually the story of one woman who lost two people that day and the impact that day had on her. And I think it's important to never lose sight of that humanity and these stories. I think that's essentially the effort here was to rob everyone of humanity. And I think we need to counter that in any way that we can. And so I can imagine coming to the memorial and each time finding something different about the panel that you stand in front of. The Memorial Foundation has worked with a group called StoryCorps. They record oral histories. And you can hear some of those stories when you stand in front of a panel on your phone. They've created an app for visitors to the memorial to listen to these stories. At the South Pool, for example, there is a panel where two brothers, the Vigiano brothers, are listed, and one was a firefighter, one was a police officer. We were able to arrange it so one group flowed into the next, and you can hear their father recalling how one of them always knew he wanted to be a firefighter, and every year for his birthday they would set a building on fire, a cardboard cereal box on top of his cake, and eat soggy cake for his birthday. And I think those stories are more powerful than anything that as a designer I could do. And if we could just plant that seed in there and let other people find ways of teasing out a story and a way of sharing that story with other people, it's powerful. We thought we were well on our way towards completion of this project, and then we got a call from the mayor's office of people with disabilities saying, if you're seated in a wheelchair, you can't see the void at the center of each pool. And I said, I know, but the most important thing is to see and be able to touch the names. And they said, that's all well and good, but we want exactly the same experience, equivalent. And I thought, okay, what can we do? And we tried to carve these openings in the main panels so that you could see through them. The fifth percentile woman, sort of on the small end, sitting in a wheelchair, her eye level is 42.3 inches. We were required by law to have a guardrail at 42 inches. So we didn't have a lot of play in height between those two numbers to try and accomplish that. And we kind of racked our brain and eventually thought, let's chamfer the corner instead of coming to a 90 degree corner. We could cut the corner and bring the viewer closer to the edge of the weir so you could see that void at the center of each pool. And you know, we're very proud of this. We realized that you know, a couple weeks later that the original towers we remembered also had chamfered corners. It felt like, oh, here's, you know, a clue all along how to solve it that was there. So we ended up with a chamfered corner whose dimension corresponds to the same geometry that was in the original towers. And we went to the MOPD and said, here's a solution. And if you put your wheelchair at the corner and look over your shoulder, you can see the void. And they said, well, not everybody can crane their neck that way. So we're like kind of pulling every last hair. And then we thought, you know, we cut it in plan, let's cut it in section. Instead of it coming straight down, the corners could project out almost like the bow of a ship. And you could bring a wheelchair right under that leading edge. And as a consequence of that, I think the corners are actually much more sculpturally beautiful than what we had initially. Instead of stopping and starting the names, we were able to transition from five rows to three rows and back to five rows, in essence creating a closed circle of names around each pool, which is poetically much more powerful and underpins, I think, the message of the memorial better. And I can tell you, I did not welcome this request when it came. And but I think design is always about constraints, responding to constraints, finding the response to do that. But it's also about a client giving you the ability to respond. And at a moment like this, there's tremendous pressure to just figure it out and move on. And a lot of terrible suggestions were made very quickly, you know, involving portions of the plaza on a scissor lift where you could go up and down if you're in a wheelchair, or elements made out of glass, or interruptions to the name panel in order to comply with this request. And it was really the people like Amanda Bird and Kate Levin, who worked for the city and who represented the mayor on this, who gave us the time when we needed it to find the appropriate design response. A few images of the memorial since it's opened. This is a picture I actually took the day that the fences came down at the corner of Liberty and Greenwich. For years, the memorial was open before, while the streets and sidewalks around it were still under construction. And so you had to get a time ticket. You had to go through security screening. And the only people who visited the memorial were people who were there to visit the memorial. And for me, it was very important to integrate it back into the life of New York City. So when the barriers came down at that corner, for me, it was in my office 2 blocks away. It was a very exciting moment. And over the intervening years, more and more, it's become open on all sides. And about 3 out of the 5 projected buildings for the World Trade Center complex have already been completed. There's still, you know, a theater under construction here and another tower that's under construction here. But Tower 1, Tower 3, and Tower 4 are fairly complete, and Tower 5 is yet to be built. And it goes back to this notion of trying to create a public space in the middle of the city, a civic and democratic space, which I think is so important to the life of New York, to the civic life of New Yorkers and for visitors from all over the world. But what looks like a plaza in the middle of the city is in fact a very complicated green roof over a lot of different program elements. We have a subway line running underneath Greenwich Street. We have a train going to New Jersey. We have a chiller plant. We have a museum. We have a retail concourse. All those uses are there. But all that complexity is not telegraphed up. It's intentionally suppressed to create a place for that feels public and open and part of the city, a place to look back and see what's no longer there. This is from more or less, you can see the towers and light beyond. I wanted to talk for a moment about the day when we dedicated the memorial, which was on the 10th anniversary of the attacks. And what a powerful day that was. I feel like everything we did up to that day, we sort of set the stage, and then the actors came on it. And that's what really brought the place to life. And how powerful that day was to witness it. These children were running around not far from where this father was when he encountered his son's name on a panel. And bringing those two uses together, I think, was so important. And they enrich and deepen the meaning of being here. Normally, I would stop my presentation here, but because I have a room full of Jews, I'm going to talk also about this project, which is a project that is not built and likely will not be built for years, but nonetheless, I felt compelled to try and contribute to it when I was approached. You can see the Dome of the Rock over here, where legend has that Abraham almost sacrificed his son Isaac before God intervened at the last minute. And this was the site of the first and second temples. You can see what is now the temple compound. Essentially, it has a perimeter wall around it. That was the wall of the old temple. This area right here is called the Western Wall, but really everything from here to here was part of that Western Wall. This is the area that I'm sure many of you have seen Orthodox Jewish men and women congregate at and pray. And we were approached by a group called Women of the Wall, as well as the Reform and Conservative movements of Judaism, both here in the US and in Israel, to create an egalitarian prayer space that would answer their needs that were being not just ignored, but banned at the Western Wall. Israel does not have an official state religion, yet somehow the Orthodox stream of Jewry has come into control of this national site. It's not privately owned, and they get to dictate how people use the site. So that means segregation by sex at the prayer space, and which is not consistent with the values of the Reform and Conservative movement. And so there was this whole battle brewing there between they were threatening to bring a case to the Israeli Supreme Court that would challenge that and most likely rule in favor of removing Orthodox control from the site and opening it up to other streams of Judaism. In an effort to sort of prevent that from happening, and this was a little hard, I was asked to design a place that would somehow be both separate and equal. And as an American, that phrase felt difficult for me, but I also thought, I have to suspend judgment if these groups are coming to me and asking for that. And I believe in the ideals of Women of the Wall and the Reform movement and the Conservative movement that I should try and help out. And so we tried to come up with something that would be not separate but equal, but separate and different and meaningful in its own way. And the site that we were given is this site right here, leading up to the corner. This is, by the way, the third holiest site to Islam in the world, Al-Aqsa Mosque, where the Prophet Muhammad ascended to heaven in his dream and returned to earth thereafter. So you can imagine it's a site that's fraught with controversy. The site is actually today an archaeological park. All of this was excavated over the last 30, 40 years. You can see what's called Robinson's Arch. That was street level when the excavation began. And this down here is the Herodian era street. That's the street that Jesus walked on. That's where the money changers were. And these big rocks that you see here are enormous. Like, that's a person by just for comparison scale. These are rocks that the Roman legion pushed over when they destroyed the Second Temple. So you're literally you're walking in history at this site. And initially, I think a lot of the groups that came to the table wanted to create something that was very similar to this, another big stone plaza in front of a stone wall. And I thought that there is a different way of approaching this. So the current conditions are, there's a small platform right here, and then a temporary platform that was erected sort of overnight here without permit. And the rest is sort of open. And you can see that there's a big change in grade from the street level up here down to the street level down here. My son actually had his bar mitzvah there 2 summers ago. That's him right there, and that's me. And we were able to, you know, men and women together celebrate this important occasion, which we wouldn't be able to do at the traditional Western wall. So we came up with a couple of study schemes, and these are very preliminary, and I just wanted to talk about the ideas behind them. One was to create a series of platforms which would tear us down from that upper level down to the Herodian street level and shelter some of these antiquities and provide shade and allow for groups to either separate or congregate as they wished. If people did want to pray separated by gender, they had the opportunity to do here. It wasn't forcing anybody to commingle, but allowing for these different opportunities. And then also trying to bring some trees and shade and perhaps even water into this, coming up to that wall, but not touching it, almost touching it, allowing a visitor to touch it, but not bearing on it. And addressing quite a complicated network of different paths, both visitor to the Temple Mount, then to go through screening, general screening, and then addressing also accessibility, providing handicap access as well as stair access. And another scheme, which was more sort of free form, that interlinked the different elements. There was a very heated and long process of negotiations, and the government agreed to sort of implement a very small fraction of what we proposed. And that was agreed to, and I'm sure not all of you are familiar with the politics in Israel, but the current Israeli government is in power because they have a coalition, a majority of votes in parliament, and that coalition requires the Orthodox Party to assent, to be part of it. And promises were made to those members of parliament in exchange for their accepting this, and then they backtracked out of it. And then U.S., you know, as much as the Israeli government values American Jews, they value staying in power even more. So the project essentially came to a standstill, as we now speak, not moving forward. And I just wanted to briefly talk about, and I can't share any designs, the process of designing the memorial here in Charleston is ongoing. And I hope that within a few months we'll be able to share some information with you. But I think here, one of the things that are important to me is to imagine, how do you create a public space that welcomes people in to the memorial. I think there's an incredible act of generosity by the church to build this memorial, because I think the people who will be served by it the most are actually complete strangers who come here from everywhere else. And so I think it's this generous act of bringing in others to help them connect to the history of what happened here that day. And I'm grateful to be involved in that project, and I hope to be able to talk more about it in the coming months. Thank you.
So we have time for a few questions. If you have any for
us. Yes,
so as a New Yorker and knowledgeable about politics up there and some of the things going on down here, do you have any comments about the statue of Marion Sims that has recently been taken down in New York and the hullabaloo related to that?
Yeah, so as I mentioned, I was on that mayoral committee, and we met a few times as a committee and then a few more times hearings in each borough to hear public comment on it, and I think a tremendous amount of credit to go to the co-chairs of that committee, Darren Walker and Tom Finkelberl, who kind of synthesized what the recommendations of the committee, but also kind of led the discussions of the committee And what came out of, and I don't recall all four salient points on this, but something I alluded to earlier is, how do we judge something not just today, but also in the context in which it was built? And we looked, and there were four statues that seemed particularly, or monuments, difficult to address. One was Marion Sims' statue. The other was Teddy Roosevelt in front of the American Museum of Natural History. And the Christopher Columbus statue, and there was a marker to Petén on Broadway. And Petén, you know, sent many Jews to their death camps when he was in charge of Vichy France. And at the end of the day, we felt that only the statue of Marion Sims was the one that met all the criteria that we thought should lead to a deliberation for its removal, because of the values that it represented both when it was erected and how it's seen today. And that's how, you know, we made our recommendation to the design committee of the city, and they deliberated on it. They thought it should be removed, and it was removed. It's now in Greenwood Cemetery at its grave, where it actually had been, I think, at some point before it was moved to the location on Fifth Avenue.
We have one in Columbia, if you'd like to take one back.
I'll pass.
You do beautiful work, thank you.
Thank you.
For the trees at the World Trade Center site, what kind are they? What will they look like in 50 to 100 years? And what do you do to keep that water from freezing in that harsh winter?
Yeah. So I'll start with the last one. The water is constantly circulated, and there's a small heat trace element at the edge of the weir, which is where the water, you know, that edge where the water falls off, to prevent that from becoming too so cold that it will freeze there. And the water is slightly heated, you know, just into the low 40s or something to prevent it from icing. You do get ice on the walls, but that melts eventually. The trees are swamp white oaks, with the exception of one tree, which is a Callery pear tree. It's called the Survivor Tree. It's actually a tree that was pulled out of the rubble after the attack. It was shorn and most of its limbs. It was nursed back to health by the Parks Department, and one of the project architects working on it for the LMDC, for the Memorial Foundation, Ron Vega, suggested bringing it back to the site, and we found a place for it. I don't think we anticipated how what a powerful symbol it would become. It's the tree that everybody goes to whenever a sad event occurs. That's where, remember, after the shooting in Florida, I should say the Pulse nightclub shooting in Florida, there was a ceremony that was held there, and everybody tied ribbons to the tree. It's where visiting dignitaries leave wreaths. It's become a symbol of survival and resilience. And and we're actually right now in the process of making changes to the 9/11 memorial, because when it was built, we didn't recognize all the rescue and recovery workers who we couldn't know at the time that so many of them would grow ill and die because of 9/11 related illnesses. And that tally is in the hundreds, if not over 1,000 by now. And we're now adding elements to the memorial plaza to address that, you know. And it's a little hard when you start a process like this, because you've walked away and you think you've created something that's perfect as it is, finally. But I'm very grateful that I'm given the opportunity to come back and make these changes in a way that commemorates something that's very important that has gone uncommemorated.
As a follow-up to this question, when James Young came and spoke a month or so ago, he described the trees as, for him, a very necessary counterpart to the voids. Mm-hmm. That one, even though the water is very beautiful, the voids could also be seen as a place of sorrow and brokenness, perhaps even gateways to the underworld. But with the trees as a counterpoint, you also have this ascendant, resurgent aspect. And I was wondering if you felt the same way, or if that was just James' interpretation.
I think the trees are an essential part of the memorial, and as they mature, I think they will also define those two voids very clearly. It's starting to happen already. there is one area of the plaza where the trees are absent. We created a glade at the southwest corner, sort of south of the North Pool, west of the South Pool. And that area has not been in much circulation. So we're creating a new path there and new memorial elements there to mark the rescue recovery effort. And I think that there's something very powerful about stepping out from underneath the canopy of the trees. First, you know, walking through New York, these sort of narrow canyons of lower Manhattan, and then coming to this big clearing, which is this 8-acre clearing, and then you go underneath the canopy of the trees and it kind of mediates the city, but then you step out onto this clearing and it's, again, it seems to, the sky seems to open up in a very unexpected way. So the trees do play a very significant role in the experience of visiting the site.
What do you think ought to be done about monuments such as the Calhoun Monument in Marion Square? And people have so many different views of the history.
I think there should be a discussion, a public discussion. And there should all these, everybody that has a stake in what Charleston is should be part of that discussion, and it should not be dictated by a single authority. Sand in an hourglass is an element that marked the passage of time. You could see its flow, that you could mark time with it, and the notion of that flow leaving an empty vessel despite the passage of time was important to me. And different people have looked at the water feature and seen different things in it. I remember the first day we turned the water feature on for the first time, and this rainbow sprung out of nowhere, and people, you know, felt that there was significance to that. I think other people see the texture of the tower, and you know, it's very sort of straight, a tower, and the waterfalls. I don't think that there is a single reading that, but it's open to people to see what's there. I think the water also acts as the sound of the water. It has an important role in visiting the memorial. It's not overpowering. You can have a conversation when you're standing there at the edge, but it does help to mask some of the noises of the city beyond. Okay, last question?
Yeah, we'll do one, maybe two more.
Okay.
Hi, I was at the memorial, I think it was exactly a year ago today, and it was a meaningful experience, and it was also, it met that idea of being a public space, because I remember sitting on one of those square areas and talking to my daughter, and kids playing, and immigrant families nearby, but there was a museum there. And when I was there, I'm like, I'm not here to go to the museum. But then later, in conversations about being there, people seemed to think that the museum was very essential, part of the whole, you know, memorial. And I still, I mean, I would like to hear a little bit more about the museum, what's there.
Yeah.
I think it goes lower, and the role that it plays with the memorial. Yeah.
So I'd say my role with the museum was fairly limited. It was proposing a roof over it, which essentially defined it by the foundation slab that was there, by the slurry wall that was there, and by the plaza that roofs over it. And it seemed like you could create some powerful places, but none of the sort of the exhibitry or the interior design of that space, or even the pavilion that leads you into the museum, were done by our office. I think the museum fulfills a mission because different people learn and respond emotionally to events in different ways. For some people, I think the memorial is probably enough. And for some people, the sort of the much more didactic nature of the museum, its exhibit, its historical retelling of the events of that led up to that day, that occurred that day, and what happened thereafter are important. So I don't see it as a sort of an either or. I think you know, for some people it's very important, and for some people, many New Yorkers who lived through it don't have a need to relive it in that detail. But I think you don't want to forget history, and I think institutions like this museum can help educate a younger generation as to what happened.
It's extremely impressive working in Europe. And I was just interested to hear you reflect on some of the lessons that you've learned, because there's some disappointments that you've clearly experienced in the work that you've been doing. And as you embark on the project here in Charleston, are there some lessons that you've derived from past experience that you think would be applied here that might be of interest to hear the rest of Europe?
So I think engagement with people and hearing multiple voices should guide a design process. I think the success of the 9/11 Memorial was rooted in a couple of ideas, which were about creating a public space, a civic public space, and about making loss visible and tangible. And there were many sort of decision tree moments where we could have gone completely off the rails and come up with a memorial that was quite different than what we had intended on day one. It could have become a much more, you know, jingoistic or self-pitying memorial. And I think that would have been a terrible occurrence if that would have happened. I think the sort of the stoicism that New York showed, the compassion, the courage, that sense of community is there. And I hope that when people come to the memorial, they sense that, they feel that. And I think in 2006, when I showed, you know, the loss of the Memorial Gallery, to me that was like, that was one way of telling that story. And as a young architect, I felt very attached to it. I thought, if I don't have the gallery, then I don't have the story. The story was there. I just needed to find a new way of reaffirming that story up on plaza level without that Memorial Gallery. And so I think having those clear ideas, having the conversation with multiple people, and then understanding that any single iteration of the design is not necessarily the most important thing. It's the how rather than the why. And I think you need to address the why and understand what you're trying to do here, and then find different ways of doing it, the most successful way of doing that. Thank you.
All right, y'all, before we get out of here, some very quick housekeeping. Tomorrow, our